Step one, make it to the podium. I'm Rush. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Anthony. If this doesn't go well, it's Kathy's fault. This was her idea. No, but I mean, it really is an honor, and just kind of looking out over the what seems like a sea of people right here. I see a lot of familiar faces, you know, and thank you guys for coming, you know, the people that I know out there. And, you know, aside from that, I mean, Anthony's right. You know, getting sober young, I mean, it truly is a gift. You know, I remember coming to one of my first meetings at the Gwinnett Room, and this was back when they smoked in meetings, and the walls were yellow, and the ashtrays. I mean, it was just such a shithole, you know. And I just remember looking around and just thinking, oh, like, my life is over, you know. And I had no idea. I just had no idea, you know, what I would get to experience here. You know, I thought this was a pretty big deal. You know, the roundup. I went to Easy 123 Sunday morning, and my good buddy Philip reminded me that it's just a Thursday night speaker and that it's free. You know? So nobody pays to be here, you know? So, you know, I just appreciate. I'm so grateful for all the lessons in humility along the way. Thank you for one more, Philip. So my intention is to tell you guys what happened to me, you know, here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm an emotional guy, especially when I talk about my experience here. So I'm going to try not to just cry my way through this, but just bear with me. But it really does come from a place of gratitude, you know, that I get to live this life today. So I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, unfortunately. March 31st, 1982. Grew up in an alcoholic family. Dad was, you know, worst of the worst. You know, he got here luckily in like 1987. I was five. But I didn't see Dad before, you know, when he was drinking, and I didn't see him after because he was coming to AA meetings, you know. And I had a mom that had her own struggles, and she would become an alcoholic later on. And then I had a brother who was a saint, you know. I mean, this kid could just do no wrong. And he got all the positive attention, and you know, in my mind, it was like, okay, well, if you're going to get the positive attention, somebody's got to get the negative attention, so watch this, you know. And that's just how it started from a really early age. We moved to the Atlanta area. I was about 6 months old. Grew up playing soccer. Loved sports. Didn't seem to have any real issues. You know, I think I took my first drink when I was six at a family wedding. And I drank and I got drunk. And I don't know what that looked like exactly. I mean, you don't remember things when you're six. At least I didn't. But the story is that I continued to go back, you know, to that fruit punch bowl at the wedding, like time after time after time, until I was found totally shit-faced on a couch somewhere, you know. So I don't know if that was the effect or if I just liked the taste, but that was my first experience with alcohol. You know, whenever I tell my story, I really don't do a very good job. Because I end up, like, I've had so many of those, like, moments where I just burn it all down and build it back and burn it all down and build it back, that I never get to the good stuff, you know? Like, I just run out of time. So my intention is to kind of scoot through, you know, some of the dark stuff and really get to the good stuff tonight. So I felt like if I vocalize that, then maybe that will become a reality. So I got in a lot of trouble as a kid. And my brother got saved at a very early age. So he was a Christian. We grew up Catholic. He converted to Baptist. I went to my first mental institution when I was 12 years old. There you go. I went to my second when I was 13. You know, and I think I went back again when I was 13. And then my first rehab when I was 14. You know, Dad left at a pretty early age. I think I was 10 when him and my mom got divorced. And the first real memory that I ever had was being in a brand new house with no furniture and looking around and just thinking, you know, this is really lonely. Like, I don't really understand what's happening here. You know, like, this is brand new. I don't get it. Don't understand why Dad had to leave. Don't understand why there's no furniture in this place yet. You know, I was just at a loss for words. I mean, I just had no idea what was happening. And the downward spiral began. You know, my mom had, I fail to mention this sometimes, but I think it's worth mentioning. She was a felony probation officer for Gwinnett County. She got off about 4 o'clock every day, and she was just plastered, you know, by 5 p.m. And she sat in front of that TV, and I had free rein to go and do whatever it is that I wanted to go do, you know. So I got connected with the guys in the neighborhood. They were drinking, they were smoking pot, they were dropping acid, doing all that kind of stuff. And that's just what we did, and I had no structure and accountability, you know. And she had, I remember this, she had a, I remember the label and what the bottle looked like, everything, but she had a bottle of Evan Williams that sat underneath that sink in her bathroom. And I would go in there and I would pull on that thing as much as I needed to. And I learned pretty quickly that I just loved the effect produced by alcohol, you know, amongst other things. And I was one of those guys. I mean, I would just do it all. You know, my sole mission was to get out of this moment right here, right now. Because I could not do it. I could not deal with it. It was too much for me. So that being said, that's what I did for a period of time. And, you know, I did all the therapists and the psychiatrists and the family psychologists to try to figure out what was wrong with me, because I wasn't acting right. And we did the mental institutions, and I ended up in a rehab at the age of 14. And I stayed in that, you know, that program until I was about 17. And I made it back to my mom's house, mom and dad's house. I know that's probably going to confuse some people, but they actually got back together. So this is the kind of dysfunction that we're dealing with here. You know, I was destined to become a junkie and an alcoholic. And so I made it back to Gwinnett County. And, you know, my brother was still doing his thing. And it was really a strange experience for me, because I was in that treatment center for about 3.5 years, and it was kind of like a bubble. They didn't really let you out much, you know, like you just hung out with people within that treatment center. And I remember having to face like the real world and like go out and get a job. And I didn't know how to do that stuff. I didn't know how to get a job. You know, I was 17 years old. And I was a boy, you know, I had no tools for living. In that treatment center, I mean, I barely put together any clean time. It took me, I think, a year to get 30 days clean. And then when I finally did get clean, I think I put together about 14 months, but that was short-lived. Experienced heartbreak for the first time, and that's all I needed. I just needed just any kind of excuse to get back out there and to change the way that I feel, you know, that I felt. And so I did that. But I just remember being, you know, like coming back to the real world and getting a job and just not knowing how to talk to people, you know. And so that was kind of a strange place. And I just, you know, it was just very dark and very lonely at times. And I finally met some people and started drinking, you know, pretty consistently. And they seemed to drink like I drank, you know. And that suited me, you know. They also had jobs. It wasn't at a, you know, at a stage where I wasn't able to show up for work. So I did that for a period of time. I think I had a job at a car wash. And then I got a job at a car dealership, and then ended up getting a job with a landscaping crew. And those guys just liked to party. So that's what we did. You know, one thing led to the next, and before I knew it, I was completely unemployable, you know, and I was drinking and I was getting high around the clock, and my family wanted nothing to do with me. I started selling drugs to support my habits. I got set up at a gas station by a confidential informant, and I had, this was kind of my first moment where I was kind of forced to look at the reality of the situation. And I remember running in, for some reason I ran inside the gas station. Like, the cops are like chasing me, and I went inside. You know, so this is the guy you guys are dealing with right now, you know. And I mean, I knew I was smoked, you know, so you know, I had something that I was about to sell to a guy, and I remember, you know, eating the bag, and the bag comes open in my stomach, and I wake up at Gwinnett Medical Center, shackled to a bed, and that was the first kind of consequence that I'd really ever had outside of the treatment in terms of like legal consequences. And I woke up to a police officer in the hospital room, and he just kind of looked at me, and he was like, you know, you're just one of the guys who just happened to wake up, you know. And I was just like, shit, he's right, you know. But I mean, that wasn't going to stop me, you know. We're nowhere near the bottom, guys, you know. So I, you know, I ended up getting out of, I think, that stint. I can't remember exactly what it was. I think I got out, and then I went back to jail for something else. And this is all, you know, up 5 days, down to living out of hotel rooms, living on the streets, you know, just doing all the things that we do when we're in active addiction and alcoholism, you know. And it was a really dark place. And I went back to jail for something else, you know, caught a possession charge. And I got to jail, and I'd gone to some meetings, you know, here and there, but I really didn't know, like, what Alcoholics Anonymous was about. All I knew was that my dad had gone to some meetings and that he had gotten sober and that he didn't drink, you know. But I mean, for me, for a guy like me, kind of coming up against these kind of consequences and starting to feel, you know, the kind of despair and destruction that we cause, I started to kind of look at that and just say, okay, well, maybe I need to look at this because I need to find a solution to this problem because this is not working anymore, you know. I don't know that it ever worked, you know. And so I went to jail, and I stayed in jail for about 8.5 months. And when I got out, I didn't know what I needed to do. I knew that I had some support from people that were sober. One of those, the main people, being my father, you know. So I went to go and live with him for a period of time, started going to some meetings, you know, up to that point, I mean, I didn't have any real friends because, like, when you're out there living the life that I was living, I mean, these people didn't want to be around me, you know? I mean, all I was doing was just looking for, you know, things to steal. I had never really known true friendship up to this point, except maybe when I was a kid, you know? And so I started going to meetings, and some guys kind of took me under their wing, and I'll never forget it. I mean, when you first get sober, I mean, we hear it all the time. Like, we just have no idea what we're in for. We're about to meet the best friends that we've ever had in our lives. And we're about to have some of the greatest experiences that we've ever had. You know, and it's such a gift. You know, and I didn't know it at the time, but that's what I was, you know, beginning to be exposed to. You know, these guys taking me under their wing and just showing me what it's like to, like, not want anything from me. Just true friendship, true love. They just wanted to help another drunk because they saw how broken I was, you know. And so I started going to meetings, and I ended up getting a sponsor, this guy by the name of Ed S. And I was really grateful for Ed. You know, being incarcerated for 8.5 months, you kind of lose that gift of desperation, you know? Like, your ass is not on fire at that point. Like, you're just like, you know, you're just 8.5 months in, and, you know, the obsession has left, you know what I mean? And the physical allergy is clearly gone. But, I mean, I was still just kind of lost, you know. And he just took me through the steps, and he guided me. I did an inventory, and he knew all the things, all the right things to ask. You know, when I look at the first step, I mean, I was pretty clear about that. You know, I saw the unmanageability and the powerlessness. You know, the God piece is something that I always struggled with, because I remember being in the Baptist church when I was 12 years old, and I remember making pacts with God, you know, because I heard the preacher talking about if you do A, B, and C, you're going to burn in hell, you know, and making promises to God right there in the sanctuary. And by 5 p.m., I had broken every single promise, you know. I just didn't have the kind of control. I didn't have willpower. That stuff didn't exist for me. So I didn't know what like a real relationship with God looked like, but I was open. I do believe that I had some sort of fundamental idea, you know, deep within me of what God was. And I grew up, you know, believing in something greater than me, you know, so I felt like I kind of had that peace. The third step, I had no idea what that meant, you know, to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. I have no idea, had no idea what that meant. Luckily, you guys know how to keep that so simple for us. And early on, in that first go around, you know, before there was really any kind of depth and weight, you know, I was told that, I mean, really, it's just a decision to go through the rest of the steps. And I could wrap my head around that. I was like, okay, I can do that. Like, I'll do the inventory process. So we went through the inventory process, did the fifth step, you know, went through six and seven. Eight was, you know, fine, just making a list. All right, that's cool. And the ninth step is when I really started to buy in. The ninth step was really, really powerful for me. You know, I remember going to meetings and I remember looking around and I remember thinking there were still a lot of full, you know, a lot of people that were full of shit, you know? And I just, you know, we suffer from that, just that terminal uniqueness, you know? And we hear that talked about in meetings. I mean, my problem was just different, you know? And I just wasn't fully bought into the idea that, like, you guys had the same thing that I did, or that there was even a solution, or what the God piece was even all about at this point, you know? I think my sponsor had just done the best that he had to work with up to that point, you know? And I remember, you know, making a list, and I remember, you know, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous and looking up on the wall and seeing the steps up there and looking at four and five and just being like, man, there ain't no way. And then looking at nine and being like, man, these people don't know the things that I've done. I can't go face that music. There's just no way. I can't do that, you know? And I'm just so grateful I had the sponsor that I had, because he took me to the part of the book that says, hey, we don't get to choose these things, Rush. Like, we do this. We go through this process, because if we don't, like, we know where we end up, you know? And I'm emotional because I'm so grateful for that man, you know, that he guided me through that process. And I didn't have anybody to pat me on the back and say, hey, it's going to be okay. Like, I mean, he was like, all right, dude, it's time to do this, you know? And so somehow, you know, I think I had saved up $500 and I got a little Plymouth Acclaim. I didn't even know where this guy lived, you know, but he was on the list. And I hated this guy with every fiber of my being. He was a guy that my father used to live with, and is a guy that I basically just went to his house when he wasn't there, and I just took everything, you know, worth any kind of value. I mean, I just robbed the guy blind. But this man was very intimidating. I mean, just his physical stature alone. I mean, he was probably like 4 feet wide, you know. And I didn't remember anything about this guy, you know, but I just remember thinking, this is a scary individual, and I'm not looking forward to this, you know. It was a guy that my dad and I had, you know, lived with, and he had kicked my dad out right after 9/11. You know, I did what I did, and this was one of the ones that was, you know, brought about the most fear within me. I had, you know, gotten a job, and I had saved up, I think, like $1,100, and I put it in an envelope, and he told me what to say. And so I drove out there. I think it was like a Sunday afternoon. Didn't even know if the guy was going to be there. Didn't even remember where he lived. You know what I mean? It's almost like God was just in control of that whole thing. And I was so scared. I remember pulling in the driveway, and my knees were just shaking. I didn't think I could face this. And I walked up the steps and I knocked on the door, and the man opened the door, and I looked him in the eye and I told him what I did. And I said, my name's Russ Jolly and I'm Steve's son, and I came here and I robbed your house and I took everything of any kind of value. I'm here to pay you back because I'm trying to get sober. And this man said, he took the envelope, first of all, and he opened it up, and he peeled off $300 and he put it in his pocket, and he handed the rest back to me, and he said, you're going to need this a whole lot more than I am. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for coming here today. Wow. And when you're in that kind of fear, you just don't know. You know, I had no relationship with a power greater than me, so I didn't know what that day looked like, but God showed me his face that day, you know? And the feeling that I had leaving that house that day was better than any drink or any drug I've ever put in my body. By a long shot. And it was in that moment that I knew that there was a solution for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. That the 12 steps were real. And that if I went through this process, that something would happen to me. You know? And I'm just so grateful for that. Meetings were great. Taking trips with the guys. Again, just kind of, you know, doing what we do in early sobriety, playing volleyball till 1 a.m. and, you know, just all that kind of stuff. Man, it was just a lot of fun, just learning how to live sober, you know. And it was just a really, really cool experience. And then I met a girl. So you guys know, you know what's coming, right? You know. We're going back. We're going back. You know, I mean, she was an alcoholic, and she was a bottom of the barrel drunk, and she was, you know, in her 20s, but I mean, she was just about as ugly as it gets when it comes to alcoholism, you know. I mean, I had kind of cross addicted to every substance known to man, and, you know, she was just strictly alcohol, and she had some relapses along the way, and I saw things that I just didn't even, I mean, I had seen it in my mom, but she took it to a new level, you know. And we were together, and at that point, I mean, I think I had a pretty good grasp on, like, what sponsorship needed to look like and just being completely honest and transparent about what's going on in our life, you know. And that's when the dishonesty started, you know. And I remember we bought a house, and I called my sponsor after we moved in, you know. like 4 years sober, like, you know. I mean, you know, you just don't know anything at 4 years sober. No offense, you know, we just don't, you know. I don't really know anything now. I honestly don't even know how I got here, you know. I mean, I'm dead serious. I really don't, you know. I feel like I have just kind of been placed, you know, and it's been a gift, because the one thing that I've done along the way is I've stayed in touch with you people, you know, and I get to get the guidance and direction from the people in these rooms, you know. So it wasn't too long, you know, started drifting away, stopped sponsoring guys. I don't even think I ever looked at the 11th step, you know. You know, did not ever practice meditation. Just skipped right over that part, you know. In the 12th step, I mean, I'd sponsored some guys, so, I mean, I understood, like, what that was about, but that became less of a priority. And that's a problem for us. That's a big problem for us. You know, when we stop, you know, being of service to other people. And it wasn't long, and I was back out there, you know. And it was funny, because, like, you would think after being sober for 4.5 years, you would have to make a conscious decision to go back out to the life that you did before. That is not the reality of this disease. All we got to do is not do these things in here, and we just wake up drunk one day. And that's what happened to me. That's what happened to me. And I stayed that way, and I saw things that I didn't know existed. I didn't think it could get any worse, and it got way worse. You know, when they talk about this disease being progressive, they're not lying. I mean, it's so real. I went to a place that I just, and it was such a wild life. Just being on the run from the cops, you know, up 5 days, down 2, just constantly delirious because I hadn't slept, hadn't eaten. I mean, I went from weighing 210 pounds to probably 145, you know, in no time. And that's how I drank, and that's how I drugged. You know, that's what I did. And I stayed out there for, you know, a couple of years. Just check time here. I had kind of a crazy experience out there, just being in complete psychosis from drinking and drugging for, you know, days on end. And there was this girl, Leah, and she had this laptop, and I think this was like circa 2006, so like laptops are like valuable, you know, like they like cost some money. And especially if you're like we are, like anything is like valuable, you know what I mean? Because I mean, I didn't have 20 bucks to my name, you know. And she wouldn't shut up about this laptop, you know. She just wouldn't shut up. She couldn't believe she had somehow scored a laptop, you know. And she was in my car. And, I mean, and this was prior. She'd been talking about this for weeks, you know, and I couldn't stand this girl. I mean, I hated her. And then we ended up in my vehicle. When I say my vehicle, it wasn't my vehicle. You know, I had stolen it from somebody. And yeah, we'd just been up for days, and we were riding down the road, and she was just, you know, just running her mouth about something, and next thing you know, like I slam, and we're in just a full blown conversation, just talking about all this different stuff and the damn laptop, you know, and next thing I know, like there's like something happened in front of me, and I had to slam on my brakes, and I slammed on my brakes. I mean, I just barely didn't hit this person going 40 miles an hour, And it just jarred me sober. And I was like, you see this asshole? You know, what the hell are they doing over there? Do you see that? And I look over and there's nobody there. There's nobody there. And I'm just like, good God. This is not good. This is not good. You know, like I'm not just like seeing like shadow people. Like I'm like having conversations with people with like, you know, like facial features, and she had a blue dress on, and like, you know, just all this kind of stuff. It was a really scary moment for me, but it just kind of showed me like what I was up against, you know. And God, this is so tough to talk about. God, I didn't want to be doing this stuff. But that's what we're dealing with here. You know? We're dealing with a disease where we literally don't have a choice. You know? I mean, that is true powerlessness. And I felt that. And I'm so grateful for that relapse. Because when the cops came again, you know, and met me at the spot, you know, at 6 a.m., God, I'll never forget the feeling that I had when my back hit that back seat of that cop car. I mean, I breathed a sigh of relief, you know, because it's finally over. And I think I stayed in jail for like 6 months. And I'm so grateful for this man, Daniel L. He came up and he saw me, you know, while I was incarcerated. And he brought a book with him. And we went through it. And, you know, I got out and I was pretty clear about who I was and what I was up against and what this disease looked like and, you know, where it was going to take me if I didn't do some things different this time, you know. And it's a really cool experience because he's the one who took me back to the book and we traced it back to like what happened, like where did it start, and we traced it back to, you know, stop sponsoring people and then stop going to meetings, and the biggest thing was this: I stopped being honest. I stopped being completely and totally transparent about what goes on up here and the behaviors that I participate in on a daily basis. And you can't put a price tag on that, you know? So September 8, 2008 was the last time I put a drink or a drug in my body. And honestly, I believe it's because I'm unwilling to lie today. And here's the truth of the matter, all right? Like, we're alcoholics. Like, that's who we are. We are going to come to the end of this program, and we're going to do some great things, and we're going to do the dumbest shit on the planet. I mean, if you're in this room and you're new, it's going to happen. You're going to do it. You're going to do it. I don't know what's worse, the dumb shit or lying about the dumb shit. I'm serious. I got people in my life today that know everything that happens in my life, the deepest, darkest stuff that I never want to talk to any about, the most embarrassing. I don't want to talk about this stuff. But God, I just love being sober today. I mean, I really do. I mean, I walked in these rooms 14 and a half years ago as a walking dead man. You know, first job was at a car wash, and, you know, went through the 12 steps with Daniel, started at a place called the Gwinnett Room, and I stayed there for a little while. I think I was probably just dry there for the first little while. I remember going over to a meeting called the Solution Group, and, God, this place scared the shit out of me. It really did. Like, it was so scary. It was so intimidating. I mean, I walked in there, and I'll tell you what I saw. I saw a bunch of men. And that scared me because I was a boy. But I knew that's where I needed to be. And I don't know if I'm able to get through this. I met a man named Mike C. He's in here tonight. And we started on this process, and I mean, that first time going through the steps was unbelievable. I mean, it really was, just because, like, I learned who God was, and I learned that there was a solution here. God, I just had so much more to learn, you know. I had so much more to learn. And all I knew was just, like what we see here on a daily basis. We go to work, and we go to the house, and we have these relationships with people and family and all this stuff, and I had no idea anything about spirituality. You know, but these men in this meeting, the solution group, they told me that if I worked the 12 steps and I did it all the way through and I continue to do it, that I would transform as an individual, and that's what happened to me. And it was just like the perfect storm, because like I was just in a position where I was like willing to hear it, you know. I was willing to hear. I was like a sponge. I was just soaking it up. Because when I got there, I was just so broken. You know, I remember walking in there. I mean, I couldn't even carry on a conversation with somebody. I mean, I would literally just walk away in mid-sentence. I couldn't do it. The anxiety was just too high. The self-esteem was just too low. I had no confidence whatsoever. You know, I was just too broken. I didn't think I was good enough for God. I didn't think I was good enough for you guys. And these people, they challenged me. They made me chair meetings and get up there, you know, scared to death and do things like that. They made me lead discussion. They even made me sit at the door and shake hands, and I hated that shit more than anything. I mean, I really did. But, I mean, those guys, I mean, they taught me how to be a man, you know. And going through that 12-step process, I'll never forget it, because he had me read a new pair of glasses. And if you haven't read that book in this room, I highly, highly suggest you read that book. I mean, it changed everything for me. And then I read another book called Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. And I read those two books back to back. And then I read another one called A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson. And y'all, I had a spiritual experience that is just out of this world. I left this place. I mean, I did for probably like 2 or 3 weeks. And I know that may sound wild to some of you, but that was my experience. You know, that was my white light, you know. I mean, it's almost like I was just floating for like 2 or 3 weeks. And all I could see in people, because I mean, I had some pretty deep-rooted resentments towards my mother, towards my boss. I mean, I hated these people. I did. I mean, I had that capacity to hate people at a very deep level. And something happened. I had a major shift. And all I could see in them was love. That's all I could see, you know. And I just, the growth that took place in that very short period of time was just unbelievable. And don't worry, I'm not bragging, because it left very soon. I mean, I'm serious. I got fired from my job like 2 months later, you know. And not just because, like, I showed up late. Like, I mean, I screamed at the boss in front of the whole restaurant, you know. I mean, this is the kind of alcoholic you're looking at. I mean, it's been a process, you know. I mean, I remember having 8 years sober and going through one of the most difficult things that I've ever been through. I was with a girl. You know, I had met a girl. We had a... This is a little different relationship, though. This was like... It was cool, and I'm glad you laughed, because you're making me go back. Because I was so scared of getting into another relationship, just because I knew I was going to screw it up. I just knew I was going to screw it up. And, I mean, I've just never been good at this stuff, man. You know, it's just, only thing I've ever known is just toxic. You know, just toxic. And, And I had gone through the 12 steps, and I had this spiritual experience, and, you know, I made some mistakes, got fired from the job, but I worked through it, continued to go to meetings, started sponsoring people. I mean, I was doing the deal, you know? I was doing the deal here, and I was grateful, and I was making, you know, there's a lot of growth there. And I met a girl. And I remember talking to my sponsor about it, and my sponsor was like, "Rush, like, you need to go after this one." Because I didn't want to do it, because I didn't want to screw it up. I was so scared of blowing it, you know, and going back out there and doing the same thing that I've always done, you know. And I just didn't want that. Like, I wanted this to be different this time. And so, I mean, he kind of like had to edge me out there, like, "Hey, this one's sober, she's doing the deal, go get her." You know what I mean? And so that was cool. That was the first time that had ever happened, you know, to me. And so honestly, I mean, we had a great relationship, you know. And when it came to an end, we were probably about 6 years into it. It was one of the most devastating things I've ever been through, you know. But I was connected to you guys, you know. I had a sponsor. I was going to meetings. I was honest about everything that was going on in my life, right? I was safe and I was protected. Exactly what the book talks about. If we do this, and we connect with these people here, and we continue to do the things that we learn here, we are safe and protected from that next drink. That's the promise we're given. And that's reality. That was my truth, you know? I can't believe, like, that level of pain that I went through, I cannot believe that I didn't go back out there and drink. You know? But I didn't. And I'm just so grateful for it. You know? And there's so many wonderful things that have happened here. You know, I think back to walking in one of those first meetings and just looking around and thinking my life is over, you know? And I look at the life that I get to live today. It's just unbelievable. You know, I worked at a car wash when I first got sober. I never thought I'd amount to anything. I had no self-esteem. I had no confidence. I know I mentioned that, but it's important to circle back to that. I started working in the field of addiction about 5 years ago because it's something that I was passionate about and I was good at talking to people, you know. And, I mean, the gifts that have happened as a result of being here and doing this deal are out of this world, you know. And it's not like, you know, I wake up and I'm free every single day. You know, that's BS, you know. If you hear that in meetings, like, go find somebody you can talk to. Yeah. You know, because you're going to have some battles and some struggles along the way. Like, that's the reality of what this life is going to look like for all of us. But it has just been such a blessing to do this with you guys. And to see what God has done in my life, you know, to see the people that He's put in my life. I just opened my own treatment center. Like, how do you go from that to this? And again, I'm bragging. Like, I'm not bragging. Like, we've only been open for 3 weeks. We have no idea what we're doing. You know? We don't. We have no idea. We joke about it all the time. You know? My partner Joe and I, we were just like, man, how did we get here? You know? And here's the deal, man. We got here with a whole lot of love and support from people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? That's been my experience. If we stay here and we stay honest and we serve and we stay connected to the people in these rooms, we get to live a life far better than anything we ever deserve. Thank you.